Blackstone Audiobooks presents
Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser. One. The magnet attracting, a waif amid forces. When Carolyn Meeber boarded the afternoon train for Chicago, her total outfit consisted of a small trunk, a cheap imitation alligator skin satchel, a small lunch in a paper box, and a yellow leather snap purse containing her ticket, a scrap of paper with her sister's address in Van Buren Street, and $4 in money. It was in August, 1889. She was 18 years of age, bright, timid, and full of the illusions of ignorance and youth. Whatever touch of regret at parting characterized her thoughts, it was certainly not for advantages now being given up. A gush of tears at her mother's farewell kiss, a touch in her throat when the cars clacked by the flour mill where her father worked by the day. A pathetic sigh as the familiar green environs of the village passed in review, and the threads which bound her so lightly to girlhood and home were irretrievably broken. To be sure, there was always the next station where one might descend and return. There was the great city, bound more closely by these very trains which came up daily. Columbia City was not so very far away, even once she was in Chicago. What, pray, is a few hours, a few hundred miles? She looked at the little slip bearing her sister's address and wondered. She gazed at the green landscape, now passing in swift review, until her swifter thoughts replaced its impression with vague conjectures of what Chicago might be. When a girl leaves her home at 18, she does one of two things. Either she falls into saving hands and becomes better, or she rapidly assumes the cosmopolitan standard of virtue and becomes worse. Of an intermediate balance under the circumstances, there is no possibility. The city has its cunning wiles, no less than the infinitely smaller and more human tempter. There are large forces which allure with all the soulfulness of expression possible in the most cultured human. The gleam of a thousand lights is often as effective as the persuasive light in a wooing and fascinating eye. Half the undoing of the unsophisticated and natural mind is accomplished by forces wholly superhuman. A blare of sound, a roar of life, a vast array of human hives appeal to the astonished senses in equivocal terms. Without a counselor at hand to whisper cautious interpretations, what falsehoods may not these things breathe into the unguarded ear? Unrecognized for what they are, their beauty, like music, too often relaxes, then weakens, then perverts the simpler human perceptions. Carolyn, or Sister Carrie, as she had been half-affectionately termed by the family, was possessed of a mind rudimentary in its power of observation and analysis. Self-interest with her was high, but not strong. It was, nevertheless, her guiding characteristic. Warm with the fancies of youth, pretty with the insipid prettiness of the formative period, possessed of a figure promising eventual shapeliness, and an eye alight with certain native intelligence, she was a fair example of the middle American class, two generations removed from the emigrant. Books were beyond her interest. Knowledge, a sealed book. In the intuitive graces, she was still crude. She could scarcely toss her head gracefully. Her hands were almost ineffectual. The feet, though small, were set flatly. And yet she was interested in her charms, quick to understand the keener pleasures of life, ambitious to gain in material things. A half-equipped little knight she was, venturing to reconnoiter the mysterious city and dreaming wild dreams of some vague, far-off supremacy which should make it prey and subject, the proper penitent, groveling at a woman's slipper. "That," said a voice in her ear, "is one of the prettiest little resorts in Wisconsin." "Is it?" she answered nervously. The train was just pulling out of Waukesha. For some time she had been conscious of a man behind. She felt him observing her mass of hair. He had been fidgeting, and with natural intuition she felt a certain interest growing in that quarter. Her maidenly reserve, and a certain sense of what was conventional under the circumstances, called her to forestall and deny this familiarity. But the daring and magnetism of the individual, born of past experiences and triumphs, prevailed. She answered. He leaned forward to put his elbows upon the back of her seat, and proceeded to make himself volubly agreeable. "Yes, that is a great resort for Chicago people. The hotels are swell. You are not too familiar with this part of the country, are you?" "Oh, yes, I am," answered Carrie. "That is, I live at Columbia City. I have never been through here, though." "So this is your first visit to Chicago," he observed. All the time she was conscious of certain features out of the side of her eye. Flush, colorful cheeks, a light mustache, a gray fedora hat. She now turned and looked upon him in full, the instincts of self-protection and coquetry mingling confusedly in her brain. "I didn't say that," she said. "Oh," he answered, in a very pleasing way and with an assumed air of mistake, "I thought you did." Here was a type of the traveling canvasser for a manufacturing house, a class which at that time was first being dubbed by the slang of the day, drummers. He came within the meaning of a still newer term, which had sprung into general use among Americans in 1880, and which concisely expressed the thought of one whose dress or manners are calculated to elicit the admiration of susceptible young women, a masher. His suit was of a striped and crossed pattern of brown wool, new at that time, but since become familiar as a business suit. The low crotch of the vest revealed a stiff shirt bosom of white and pink stripes. From his coat sleeves protruded a pair of linen cuffs of the same pattern, fastened with large gold plate buttons, set with the common yellow agates known as cat's eyes. His fingers bore several rings, one the ever-enduring heavy seal, and from his vest dangled a neat gold watch-chain, from which was suspended the secret insignia of the Order of Elks. The whole suit was rather tight-fitting, and was finished off with heavy-soled tan shoes, highly polished, and the gray fedora hat. He was, for the order of intellect represented, attractive, and whatever he had to recommend him, you may be sure, was not lost upon Carrie in this, her first glance. Lest this order of individuals should permanently pass, let me put down some of the most striking characteristics of his most successful manner and method. Good clothes, of course, were the first essential, the things without which he was nothing. A strong physical nature, actuated by a keen desire for the feminine, was the next. A mind free of any consideration of the problems or forces of the world, and actuated not by greed, but by an insatiable love of variable pleasure. His method was always simple. Its principal element was daring, backed, of course, by an intense desire and admiration for the sex. Let him meet with a young woman twice, and he would straighten her necktie for her, and perhaps address her by her first name. In the great department stores he was at his ease. If he caught the attention of some young woman while waiting for the cash boy to come back with his change, he would find out her name, her favorite flower, where a note would reach her, and perhaps pursue the delicate task of friendship until it proved unpromising, when it would be relinquished. He would do very well with more pretentious women, though the burden of expense was a slight deterrent. Upon entering a parlor car, for instance, he would select a chair next to the most promising bit of femininity, and soon inquire if she cared to have the shade lowered. Before the train cleared the yards, he would have the porter bring her a footstool. At the next lull in his conversational progress, he would find her something to read. And from then on, by dint of compliment, gently insinuated, personal narrative, exaggeration, and service, he would win her tolerance and, mayhap, regard. A woman should someday write the complete philosophy of clothes. No matter how young, it is one of the things she wholly comprehends. There is an indescribably faint line in the matter of man's apparel, which somehow divides for her those who are worth glancing at and those who are not. Once an individual has passed this faint line on the way downward, he will get no glance from her. There is another line at which the dress of a man will cause her to study her own. This line the individual at her elbow now marked for Carrie. She became conscious of an inequality. Her own plain blue dress, with its black cotton tape trimmings, now seemed to her shabby. She felt the worn state of her shoes. "Let's see," he went on. "I know quite a number of people in your town. Morgan Roth, the clothier, and Gibson, the dry goods man." "Oh, do you?" she interrupted, aroused by memories of longings their show windows had cost her. At last he had found a clue to her interest, and followed it deftly. In a few minutes he had come about into her seat. He talked of sales of clothing, his travels, Chicago, and the amusements of that city. "If you are going there, you will enjoy it immensely. Have you relatives?" "I am going to visit my sister," she explained. "You want to see Lincoln Park," he said, "and Michigan Boulevard. They are putting up great buildings there. It's a second New York. Great. So much to see. Theaters, crowds, fine houses. Oh, you'll like that." There was a little ache in her fancy of all he described. Her insignificance in the presence of so much magnificence faintly affected her. She realized that hers was not to be a round of pleasure, and yet there was something promising in all the material prospect he set forth. There was something satisfactory in the attention of this individual with his good clothes. She could not help smiling as he told her of some popular actress of whom she reminded him. She was not silly, and yet attention of this sort had its weight. "You will be in Chicago some little time, won't you?" he observed at one turn of the now easy conversation. "I don't know," said Carrie vaguely, a flash vision of the possibility of her not securing employment rising in her mind. "Several weeks, anyhow," he said, looking steadily into her eyes. There was much more passing now than the mere words indicated. He recognized the indescribable thing that made up for fascination and beauty in her. She realized that she was of interest to him from the one standpoint which a woman both delights in and fears. Her manner was simple, though for the very reason that she had not yet learned the many little affectations with which women conceal their true feelings. Some things she did appeared bold. A clever companion, had she ever had one, would have warned her never to look a man in the eyes so steadily. "Why do you ask?" she said. "Well, I'm going to be there several weeks. I'm going to study stock at our place and get new samples. I might show you round." "I don't know whether you can or not. I mean, I don't know whether I can. I shall be living with my sister and—" "Well, if she minds, we'll fix that." He took out his pencil and a little pocket notebook, as if it were all settled. "What is your address there?" She fumbled her purse, which contained the address slip. He reached down in his hip pocket and took out a fat purse. It was filled with slips of paper, some mileage books, a roll of greenbacks. It impressed her deeply. Such a purse had never been carried by anyone attentive to her. Indeed, an experienced traveler, a brisk man of the world, had never come within such close range before. The purse, the shiny tan shoes, the smart new suit, and the air with which he did things built up for her a dim world of fortune of which he was the center. It disposed her pleasantly toward all he might do. He took out a neat business card on which was engraved Bartlett, Cario and Company, and down in the left-hand corner, Charles H. Drouet. "That's me," he said, putting the card in her hand and touching his name. "It's pronounced Drouet. Our family was French on my father's side." She looked at it while he put up his purse. Then he got out a letter from a bunch in his coat pocket. "This is the house I travel for," he went on, pointing to a picture on it, corner of state and lake. There was pride in his voice. He felt that it was something to be connected with such a place, and he made her feel that way. "What is your address?" he began again, fixing his pencil to write. She looked at his hand. "Carrie Meeber," she said slowly, 354 West Van Buren Street, care S.C. Hansen." He wrote it carefully down and got out the purse again. "You'll be at home if I come around Monday night?" he said. "I think so," she answered. How true it is that words are but the vague shadows of the volumes we mean. Little audible links they are, chaining together great inaudible feelings and purposes. Here were these two, banding little phrases, drawing purses, looking at cards, and both unconscious of how inarticulate all their real feelings were. Neither was wise enough to be sure of the working of the mind of the other. He could not tell how his luring succeeded. She could not realize that she was drifting until he secured her address. Now she felt that she had yielded something, he that he had gained a victory. Already they felt that they were somehow associated. Already he took control in directing the conversation. His words were easy. Her manner was relaxed. They were nearing Chicago. Signs were everywhere numerous. Trains flashed by them. Across wide stretches of flat open prairie, they could see lines of telegraph poles stalking across the fields toward the great city. Far away were indications of suburban towns, some big smokestacks towering high in the air. Frequently there were two-story frame houses standing out in the open fields without fence or trees, lone outposts of the approaching army of homes. To the child, the genius with imagination, or the wholly untraveled, the approach to a great city for the first time is a wonderful thing. Particularly if it be evening, that mystic period between the glare and gloom of the world, when life is changing from one sphere or condition to another. Ah, the promise of the night! What does it not hold for the weary? What old illusion of hope is not here forever repeated? Says the soul of the toiler to itself, "I shall soon be free. I shall be in the ways and the hosts of the merry. The streets, the lamps, the lighted chambers set for dining are for me. The theater, the halls, the parties, the ways of rest and the paths of song, these are mine in the night." Though all humanity be still enclosed in the shops, the thrill runs abroad. It is in the air. The dullest feel something which they may not always express or describe. It is the lifting of the burden of toil. Sister Carrie gazed out of the window. Her companion, affected by her wonder, so contagious are all things, felt anew some interest in the city and pointed out its marvels. "This is northwest Chicago," said Drouet. "This is the Chicago River," and he pointed to a little muddy creek crowded with the huge masted wanderers from far-off waters nosing the black-posted banks. With a puff, a clang and a clatter of rails, it was gone. "Chicago is getting to be a great town," he went on. "It's a wonder. You'll find lots to see here." She did not hear this very well. Her heart was troubled by a kind of terror. The fact that she was alone, away from home, rushing into a great sea of life and endeavor, began to tell. She could not help but feel a little choked for breath, a little sick as her heart beat so fast. She half closed her eyes and tried to think it was nothing, that Columbia City was only a little way off. "Chicago? Chicago?" called the brakeman, slamming open the door. They were rushing into a more crowded yard, alive with the clatter and clang of life. She began to gather up her poor little grip and closed her hand firmly upon her purse. Drouet arose, kicked his legs to straighten his trousers, and seized his clean yellow grip. "I suppose your people will be here to meet you," he said. "Let me carry your grip."
"Oh, no," she said. "I'd rather you wouldn't. I'd rather you wouldn't be with me when I meet my sister."
"All right," he said in all kindness. "I'll be near, though, in case she isn't here, and take you out there safely."
"You're so kind," said Carrie, feeling the goodness of such attention in her strange situation.
"Chicago," called the brakeman, drawing the word out long. They were under a great shadowy train shed, where the lamps were already beginning to shine out, with passenger cars all about and the train moving at a snail's pace. The people in the car were all up and crowding about the door.
"Well, here we are," said Drouet, leading the way to the door. "Goodbye till I see you Monday."
"Goodbye," she answered, taking his proffered hand. "Remember, I'll be looking till you find your sister." She smiled into his eyes. They filed out, and he affected to take no notice of her. A lean-faced, rather commonplace woman recognized Carrie on the platform and hurried forward.
"Why, Sister Carrie," she began,
and there was a perfunctory embrace of welcome. Carrie realized the change of affectional atmosphere at once. Amid all the maze, uproar, and novelty, she felt cold reality taking her by the hand. No world of light and merriment, no round of amusement. Her sister carried with her most of the grimness of shift and toil.
"Why, how are all the folks at home?" she began. "How is father and mother?"
Carrie answered, but was looking away. Down the aisle, toward the gate leading into the waiting room and the street, stood Drouet. He was looking back. When he saw that she saw him and was safe with her sister, he turned to go, sending back the shadow of a smile. Only Carrie saw it. She felt something lost to her when he moved away. When he disappeared, she felt his absence thoroughly. With her sister, she was much alone, a lone figure in a tossing, thoughtless sea.
2. What Poverty Threatened, of Granite and Brass. Minnie's flat, as the one-floor resident apartments were then being called, was in a part of West Van Buren Street inhabited by families of laborers and clerks, men who had come, and were still coming, with the rush of population pouring in at the rate of 50,000 a year. It was on the third floor, the front windows looking down into the street, where, at night, the lights of grocery stores were shining and children were playing. To Carrie, the sound of the little bells upon the horse cars, as they tinkled in and out of hearing, was as pleasing as it was novel. She gazed into the lighted street when Minnie brought her into the front room, and wondered at the sounds, the movement, the murmur of the vast city, which stretched for miles and miles in every direction. Mrs. Hansen, after the first greetings were over, gave Carrie the baby and proceeded to get supper. Her husband asked a few questions and sat down to read the evening paper. He was a silent man, American-born, of a Swede father, and now employed as a cleaner of refrigerator cars at the stockyards. To him, the presence or absence of his wife's sister was a matter of indifference. Her personal appearance did not affect him one way or the other. His one observation to the point was concerning the chances of work in Chicago.
"It's a big place," he said. "You can get in somewhere in a few days. Everybody does."
It had been tacitly understood beforehand that she was to get work and pay her board. He was of a clean, saving disposition, and had already paid a number of monthly installments on two lots far out on the west side. His ambition was someday to build a house on them. In the interval which marked the preparation of the meal, Carrie found time to study the flat. She had some slight gift of observation, and that sense, so rich in every woman, intuition.
She felt the drag of a lean and narrow life. The walls of the room were discordantly papered. The floors were covered with matting, and the hall laid with a thin rag carpet. One could see that the furniture was of that poor, hurriedly patched-together quality sold by the installment houses. She sat with Minnie in the kitchen, holding the baby, until it began to cry. Then she walked and sang to it, until Hansen, disturbed in his reading, came and took it. A pleasant side to his nature came out here. He was patient. One could see that he was very much wrapped up in his offspring. "Now, now," he said, walking. "There, there." And there was a certain Swedish accent noticeable in his voice. "You want to see the city first, won't you?" said Minnie, when they were eating. "Well, we'll go out Sunday and see Lincoln Park." Carrie noticed that Hansen had said nothing to this. He seemed to be thinking of something else. "Well," she said, "I think I'll look around tomorrow. I've got Friday and Saturday, and it won't be any trouble. Which way is the business part?" Minnie began to explain, but her husband took this part of the conversation to himself. "It's that way," he said, pointing east. "That's east." Then he went off into the longest speech he had yet indulged in concerning the lay of Chicago. "You'd better look in those big manufacturing houses along Franklin Street and just the other side of the river," he concluded. "Lots of girls work there. You could get home easy, too. It isn't very far." Carrie nodded and asked her sister about the neighborhood. The latter talked in a subdued tone, telling the little she knew about it, while Hansen concerned himself with the baby. Finally, he jumped up and handed the child to his wife. "I've got to get up early in the morning, so I'll go to bed." And off he went, disappearing into the dark little bedroom off the hall for the night. "He works way down at the stockyards," explained Minnie, "so he's got to get up at 5:30. "What time do you get up to get breakfast?" asked Carrie. "At about 5:20. Together they finished the labor of the day, Carrie washing the dishes while Minnie undressed the baby and put it to bed. Minnie's manner was one of trained industry, and Carrie could see that it was a steady round of toil with her. She began to see that her relations with Drouet would have to be abandoned. He could not come here. She read from the manner of Hansen, in the subdued air of Minnie, and indeed the whole atmosphere of the flat, a settled opposition to anything save a conservative round of toil. If Hansen sat every evening in the front room and read his paper, if he went to bed at 9 and Minnie a little later, what would they expect of her? She saw that she would first need to get work and establish herself on a paying basis before she could think of having company of any sort. Her little flirtation with Drouet seemed now an extraordinary thing. "No," she said to herself, "he can't come here." She asked Minnie for ink and paper, which were upon the mantel in the dining room, and when the latter had gone to bed at 10, she got out Drouet's card and wrote him, "I cannot have you call on me here. You will have to wait until you hear from me again. My sister's place is so small." She troubled herself over what else to put in the letter. She wanted to make some reference to their relations upon the train, but was too timid. She concluded by thanking him for his kindness in a crude way, then puzzled over the formality of signing her name, and finally decided upon the severe, ending up with a "very truly," which she subsequently changed to "sincerely." She sealed and addressed the letter, and going to the front room, the alcove of which contained her bed, drew the one small rocking chair up to the open window and sat looking out upon the night and streets in silent wonder. Finally, wearied by her own reflections, she began to grow dull in her chair, and feeling the need of sleep, arranged her clothing for the night and went to bed. When she awoke at 8 the next morning, Hansen had gone. Her sister was busy in the dining room, which was also the sitting room, sewing. She worked, after dressing, to arrange a little breakfast for herself, and then advised with Minnie as to which way to look. The latter had changed considerably since Carrie had seen her. She was now a thin, though rugged, woman of 27, with ideas of life colored by her husband's,
and fast hardening into narrow conceptions of pleasure and duty than had ever been hers in a thoroughly circumscribed youth. She had invited Carrie, not because she longed for her presence, but because the latter was dissatisfied at home and could probably get work and pay her board here. She was pleased to see her in a way, but reflected her husband's point of view in the matter of work. Anything was good enough so long as it paid, say, $5 a week to begin with. A shop girl was the destiny prefigured for the newcomer. She would get in one of the great shops and do well enough until, well, until something happened. Neither of them knew exactly what. They did not figure on promotion. They did not exactly count on marriage. Things would go on, though in a dim kind of way, until the better thing would eventuate, and Carrie would be rewarded for coming and toiling in the city. It was under such auspicious circumstances that she started out this morning to look for work. Before following her in her round of seeking, let us look at the sphere in which her future was to lie. In 1889, Chicago had the peculiar qualifications of growth which made such adventuresome pilgrimages, even on the part of young girls, plausible. Its many and growing commercial opportunities gave it widespread fame, which made of it a giant magnet, drawing to itself from all quarters the hopeful and the hopeless, those who had their fortune yet to make, and those whose fortunes and affairs had reached a disastrous climax elsewhere. It was a city of over 500,000, with the ambition, the daring, the activity of a metropolis of a million. Its streets and houses were already scattered over an area of 75 square miles. Its population was not so much thriving upon established commerce as upon the industries which prepared for the arrival of others. The sound of the hammer engaged upon the erection of new structures was everywhere heard. Great industries were moving in. The huge railroad corporations, which had seized upon vast tracts of land for transfer and shipping purposes. Streetcar lines had been extended far out into the open country in anticipation of rapid growth. The city had laid miles and miles of streets and sewers through regions where, perhaps, one solitary house stood out alone, a pioneer of the populous ways to be. There were regions open to the sweeping winds and rain, which were yet lighted throughout the night with long, blinking lines of gas lamps fluttering in the wind. Narrow boardwalks extended out, passing here a house and there a store, at far intervals, eventually ending on the open prairie. In the central portion was the vast wholesale and shopping district to which the uninformed seeker for work usually drifted. It was a characteristic of Chicago then, and one not generally shared by other cities, that individual firms of any pretension occupied individual buildings. The presence of ample ground made this possible. It gave an imposing appearance to most of the wholesale houses, whose offices were upon the ground floor and in plain view of the street. The large plates of window glass, now so common, were then rapidly coming into use, and gave to the ground floor offices a distinguished and prosperous look. The casual wanderer could see, as he passed, a polished array of office fixtures, much frosted glass, clerks hard at work, and genteel businessmen in knobby suits and clean linen lounging about or sitting in groups. Polished brass or nickel signs at the square stone entrances announced the firm and the nature of the business in rather neat and reserved terms. The entire metropolitan center possessed a high and mighty air calculated to overawe and abash the common applicant, and to make the gulf between poverty and success seem both wide and deep. Into this important commercial region the timid Carrie went. She walked east along Van Buren Street, through a region of lessening importance, until it deteriorated into a mass of shanties and coal yards, and finally verged upon the river. She walked bravely forward, led by an honest desire to find employment, and allayed at every step by the interest of the unfolding scene and a sense of helplessness amid so much evidence of power and force which she did not understand. These vast buildings, what were they? These strange energies and huge interests, for what purposes were they there? She could have understood the meaning of a little stonecutter's yard at Columbia City, carving little pieces of marble for individual use, but when the yards of some huge stone corporation came into view, filled with spur tracks and flat cars, transpierced by docks from the river and traversed overhead by immense trundling cranes of wood and steel, it lost all significance in her little world. It was so with the vast railroad yards, with the crowded array of vessels she saw at the river, and the huge factories over the way, lining the water's edge. Through the open windows she could see the figures of men and women in working aprons moving busily about. The great streets were wall-lined mysteries to her, the vast offices, strange mazes which concerned far-off individuals of importance. She could only think of people connected with them as counting money, dressing magnificently, and riding in carriages. What they dealt in, how they labored, to what end it all came, she had only the vaguest conception. It was all wonderful, all vast, all far removed, and she sank in spirit inwardly and fluttered feebly at the heart as she thought of entering any one of these mighty concerns and asking for something to do, something that she could do, anything. 3. We question of fortune. $4.50 a week. Once across the river and into the wholesale district, she glanced about her for some likely door at which to apply. As she contemplated the wide windows and imposing signs, she became conscious of being gazed upon and understood for what she was, a wage seeker. She had never done this thing before and lacked courage. To avoid a certain indefinable shame she felt at being caught spying about for a position, she quickened her steps and assumed an air of indifference supposedly common to one upon an errand. In this way she passed many manufacturing and wholesale houses without once glancing in. At last, after several blocks of walking, she felt that this would not do, and began to look about again, though without relaxing her pace. A little way on she saw a great door which, for some reason, attracted her attention. It was ornamented by a small brass sign and seemed to be the entrance to a vast hive of 6 or 7 floors. Perhaps, she thought, they may want someone, and crossed over to enter. When she came within a score of feet of the desired goal, she saw through the window a young man in a gray checked suit. That he had anything to do with the concern she could not tell, but because he happened to be looking in her direction, her weakening heart misgave her, and she hurried by, too overcome with shame to enter. Over the way stood a great 6-story structure labeled Storm and King, which she viewed with rising hope. It was a wholesale dry goods concern and employed women. She could see them moving about now and then upon the upper floors. This place she decided to enter no matter what. She crossed over and walked directly toward the entrance. As she did so, 2 men came out and paused in the door. A telegraph messenger in blue dashed past her and up the few steps that led to the entrance and disappeared. Several pedestrians out of the hurrying throng which filled the sidewalks passed about her as she paused, hesitating. She looked helplessly around and then, seeing herself observed, retreated. It was too difficult a task. She could not go past them. So severe a defeat told sadly upon her nerves. Her feet carried her mechanically forward, every foot of her progress being a satisfactory portion of a flight which she gladly made. Block after block passed by. Upon street lamps at the various corners, she read names such as Madison, Monroe, LaSalle, Clark, Dearborn, State, and still she went, her feet beginning to tire upon the broad stone flagging. She was pleased in part that the streets were bright and clean. The morning sun, shining down with steadily increasing warmth, made the shady side of the streets pleasantly cool. She looked at the blue sky overhead with more realization of its charm than had ever come to her before. Her cowardice began to trouble her in a way. She turned back, resolving to hunt up Storm and King and enter. On the way, she encountered a great wholesale shoe company, through the broad plate windows of which she saw an enclosed executive department hidden by frosted glass. Without this enclosure, but just within the street entrance, sat a gray-haired gentleman at a small table with a large open ledger before him. She walked by this institution several times, hesitating, but finding herself unobserved, faltered past the screen door and stood humbly waiting.
"Well, young lady," observed the old gentleman, looking at her somewhat kindly, "what is it you wish?"
Do you need any help?" she stammered.
"Not just at present," he answered, smiling. "Not just at present. Come in sometime next week. Occasionally we need someone."
She received the answer in silence and backed awkwardly out. The pleasant nature of her reception rather astonished her. She had expected that it would be more difficult, that something cold and harsh would be said, she knew not what. That she had not been put to shame and made to feel her unfortunate position seemed remarkable. Somewhat encouraged, she ventured into another large structure. It was a clothing company, and more people were in evidence, well-dressed men of 40 and more, surrounded by brass railings. An office boy approached her.
"Who is it you wish to see?" he asked.
"I want to see the manager," she said. He ran away and spoke to one of a group of three men who were conferring together. One of these came toward her.
"Well?" he said coldly. The greeting drove all courage from her at once.
"Do you need any help?" she stammered.
"No," he replied abruptly, and turned upon his heel. She went foolishly out, the office boy deferentially swinging the door for her, and gladly sank into the obscuring crowd. It was a severe setback to her recently pleased mental state. Now she walked quite aimlessly for a time, turning here and there, seeing one great company after another, but finding no courage to prosecute her single inquiry. High noon came, and with it hunger. She hunted out an unassuming restaurant and entered, but was disturbed to find that the prices were exorbitant for the size of her purse. A bowl of soup was all that she could afford, and with this quickly eaten, she went out again. It restored her strength somewhat and made her moderately bold to pursue the search. In walking a few blocks to fix upon some probable place, she again encountered the firm of Storm and King, and this time managed to get in. Some gentlemen were conferring close at hand, but took no notice of her. She was left standing, gazing nervously upon the floor. When the limit of her distress had been nearly reached, she was beckoned to by a man at one of the many desks within the nearby railing.
"Who is it you wish to see?" he inquired.
"Why, anyone, if you please," she answered. "I am looking for something to do."
"Oh, you want to see Mr. McManus," he returned.
"Sit down." And he pointed to a chair against the neighboring wall. He went on leisurely writing, until after a time a short, stout gentleman came in from the street.
"Mr. McManus," called the man at the desk. "This young woman wants to see you."
The short gentleman turned about toward Carrie, and she arose and came forward.
"What can I do for you, miss?" he inquired, surveying her curiously.
"I want to know if I can get a position," she inquired.
"As what?" he asked.
"Not as anything in particular," she faltered.
"Have you ever had any experience in the wholesale dry goods business?" he questioned.
"No, sir," she replied.
"Are you a stenographer or typewriter?"
"No, sir."
"Well, we haven't anything here," he said. "We employ only experienced help."
She began to step backward toward the door when something about her plaintive face attracted him.
"Have you ever worked at anything before?" he inquired.
"No, sir," she said.
"Well, now it's hardly possible that you would get anything to do in a wholesale house of this kind. Have you tried the department stores?"
She acknowledged that she had not.
"Well, if I were you," he said, looking at her rather genially,
I would try the department stores. They often need young women as clerks.
Thank you, she said, her whole nature relieved by this spark of friendly interest.
Yes, he said as she moved toward the door. You try the department stores.
And off he went.
At that time, the department store was in its earliest form of successful operation, and there were not many. The first three in the United States, established about 1884, were in Chicago. Carrie was familiar with the names of several through the advertisements in the Daily News, and now proceeded to seek them. The words of Mr. McManus had somehow managed to restore her courage, which had fallen low, and she dared to hope that this new line would offer her something. Sometimes she spent in wandering up and down, thinking to encounter the buildings by chance, so readily is the mind, bent upon prosecuting a hard but needful errand, eased by that self-deception which the semblance of search without the reality gives. At last she inquired of a police officer and was directed to proceed 2 blocks up, where she would find the fair. The nature of these vast retail combinations, should they ever permanently disappear, will form an interesting chapter in the commercial history of our nation. Such a flowering out of a modest trade principle the world had never witnessed up to that time. They were along the line of the most effective retail organization, with hundreds of stores coordinated into one and laid out upon the most imposing and economic basis. They were handsome, bustling, successful affairs, with a host of clerks and a swarm of patrons. Carrie passed along the busy aisles, much affected by the remarkable displays of trinkets, dress goods, stationery, and jewelry. Each separate counter was a showplace of dazzling interest and attraction. She could not help feeling the claim of each trinket and valuable upon her personally, and yet she did not stop. There was nothing there which she could not have used. Nothing which she did not long to own. The dainty slippers and stockings, the delicately frilled skirts and petticoats, the laces, ribbons, hair combs, purses, all touched her with individual desire, and she felt keenly the fact that not any of these things were in the range of her purchase. She was a work-seeker, an outcast without employment, one whom the average employee could tell at a glance was poor and in need of a situation. It must not be thought that anyone could have mistaken her for a nervous, sensitive, high-strung nature, cast unduly upon a cold, calculating, and unpoetic world. Such, certainly, she was not. But women are peculiarly sensitive to their adornment. Not only did Carrie feel the drag of desire for all which was new and pleasing in apparel for women, but she noticed, too, with a touch at the heart, the fine ladies who elbowed and ignored her, brushing past in utter disregard of her presence, themselves eagerly enlisted in the materials which the store contained. Carrie was not familiar with the appearance of her more fortunate sisters of the city. Neither had she before known the nature and appearance of the shopgirls with whom she now compared poorly. They were pretty in the main, some even handsome, with an air of independence and indifference which added, in the case of the more favored, a certain piquancy. Their clothes were neat, in many instances fine, and wherever she encountered the eye of one, it was only to recognize in it a keen analysis of her own position, her individual shortcomings of dress, and that shadow of manner which she thought must hang about her, and make clear to all who and what she was. A flame of envy lighted in her heart. She realized in a dim way how much the city held, wealth, fashion, ease, every adornment for women, and she longed for dress and beauty with a whole heart. On the second floor were the managerial offices, to which, after some inquiries, she was now directed. There she found other girls ahead of her, applicants like herself, but with more of that self-satisfied and independent air which experience of the city lends, girls who scrutinized her in a painful manner. After a wait of perhaps 3/4 of an hour, she was called in turn. "Now," said a sharp, quick-mannered Jew who was sitting at a roll-top desk near the window. "Have you ever worked in any other store?"
"No, sir," said Carrie.
"Oh, you haven't," he said, eyeing her keenly.
"No, sir,"
she replied. "Well, we prefer young women just now with some experience. I guess we can't use you."
Carrie stood waiting a moment, hardly certain whether the interview had terminated.
"Don't wait," he exclaimed. "Remember, we are very busy here."
Carrie began to move quickly to the door.
"Hold on," he said, calling her back. "Give me your name and address. We want girls occasionally."
When she had gotten safely into the street, she could scarcely restrain the tears. It was not so much the particular rebuff which she had just experienced, but the whole abashing trend of the day. She was tired and nervous. She abandoned the thought of appealing to the other department stores, and now wandered on, feeling a certain safety and relief in mingling with the crowd. In her indifferent wandering, she turned into Jackson Street, not far from the river, and was keeping her way along the south side of that imposing thoroughfare, when a piece of wrapping paper, written on with marking ink and tacked up on the door, attracted her attention. It read, "Girls Wanted, Wrappers and Stitchers." She hesitated a moment, and then entered. The firm of Spiegelheim and Company, makers of boys' caps, occupied one floor of the building, 50 feet in width and some 80 feet in depth. It was a place rather dingily lighted, the darkest portions having incandescent lights, filled with machines and workbenches. At the latter labored quite a company of girls and some men. The former were drabby-looking creatures, stained in face with oil and dust, clad in thin, shapeless cotton dresses, and shod with more or less worn shoes. Many of them had their sleeves rolled up, revealing bare arms, and in some cases, owing to the heat, their dresses were open at the neck. They were a fair type of nearly the lowest order of shop girls, careless, slouchy, and more or less pale from confinement. They were not timid, however, were rich in curiosity, and strong in daring and slang. Carrie looked about her, very much disturbed and quite sure that she did not want to work here. Aside from making her uncomfortable by sidelong glances, no one paid her the least attention. She waited until the whole department was aware of her presence. Then some word was sent around, and a foreman in an apron and shirt sleeves, the latter rolled up to his shoulders, approached. "Do you want to see me?" he asked. "Do you need any help?" said Carrie, already learning directness of address.
"Do you know how to stitch caps?" he returned.
"No, sir," she replied.
"Have you ever had any experience at this kind of work?" he inquired.
She answered that she had not.
"Well," said the foreman, scratching his ear meditatively, "we do need a stitcher. We like experienced help, though. We've hardly got time to break people in."
He paused and looked away out of the window.
"We might, though, put you at finishing," he concluded reflectively.
"How much do you pay a week?" ventured Carrie, emboldened by a certain softness in the man's manner and his simplicity of address.
3 1/2, he answered.
"Oh,"
she was about to exclaim, but checked herself and allowed her thoughts to die without expression. "We're not exactly in need of anybody," he went on vaguely, looking her over as one would a package. "You can come on Monday morning, though," he added, "and I'll put you to work."
"Thank you," said Carrie weakly.
"If you come, bring an apron," he added.
He walked away and left her standing by the elevator, never so much as inquiring her name. While the appearance of the shop and the announcement of the price paid per week operated very much as a blow to Carrie's fancy, the fact that work of any kind was offered after so rude a round of experience was gratifying. She could not begin to believe that she would take the place, modest as her aspirations were. She had been used to better than that. Her mere experience and the free outdoor life of the country caused her nature to revolt at such confinement. Dirt had never been her share. Her sister's flat was clean. This place was grimy and low. The girls were careless and hardened. They must be bad-minded and hearted, she imagined. Still, a place had been offered her. Surely Chicago was not so bad if she could find one place in one day. She might find another and better later. Her subsequent experiences were not of a reassuring nature, however. From all the more pleasing or imposing places, she was turned away abruptly with the most chilling formality. In others where she applied, only the experienced were required. She met with painful rebuffs, the most trying of which had been in a manufacturing cloak house, where she had gone to the fourth floor to inquire.
"No, no," said the foreman, a rough, heavily built individual who looked after a miserably lighted workshop. "We don't want anyone. Don't come here."
With the wane of the afternoon went her hopes, her courage, and her strength. She had been astonishingly persistent. So earnest an effort was well deserving of a better reward. On every hand, to her fatigued senses, the great business portion grew larger, harder, more stolid in its indifference. It seemed as if it was all closed to her, that the struggle was too fierce for her to hope to do anything at all. Men and women hurried by in long, shifting lines. She felt the flow of the tide of effort and interest, felt her own helplessness without quite realizing the wisp on the tide that she was. She cast about vainly for some possible place to apply, but found no door which she had the courage to enter. It would be the same thing all over. The old humiliation of her plea, rewarded by curt denial. Sick at heart and in body, she turned to the west, the direction of Minnie's flat, which she had now fixed in mind, and began that wearisome, baffled retreat which the seeker for employment at nightfall too often makes. In passing through Fifth Avenue, south toward Van Buren Street, where she intended to take a car, she passed the door of a large wholesale shoe house, through the plate-glass window of which she could see a middle-aged gentleman sitting at a small desk. One of those forlorn impulses which often grow out of a fixed sense of defeat, the last sprouting of a baffled and uprooted growth of ideas, seized upon her. She walked deliberately through the door and up to the gentleman, who looked at her weary face with particularly awakened interest. "What is it?" he said. "Can you give me something to do?" said Carrie. "Now I really don't know," he said kindly. "What kind of work is it you want? You're not a typewriter, are you?"
"Oh, no," answered Carrie.
"Well, we only employ bookkeepers and typewriters here. You might go around to the side and inquire upstairs. They did want some help upstairs a few days ago. Ask for Mr. Brown."
She hastened around to the side entrance and was taken up by the elevator to the fourth floor.
"Call Mr. Brown, Willie," said the elevator man to a boy nearby. Willie went off, and presently returned with the information that Mr. Brown said she should sit down, and that he would be around in a little while. It was a portion of the stockroom which gave no idea of the general character of the place, and Carrie could form no opinion of the nature of the work.
"So you want something to do," said Mr. Brown, after he inquired concerning the nature of her errand. "Have you ever been employed in a shoe factory before?"
"No, sir," said Carrie.
"What is your name?" he inquired. And being informed, "Well, I don't know as I have anything for you. Would you work for 4.5 a week?"
Carrie was too worn by defeat not to feel that it was considerable. She had not expected that he would offer her less than 6. She acquiesced, however, and he took her name and address.
"Well," he said finally, "you report here at 8 o'clock Monday morning. I think I can find something for you to do."
He left her revived by the possibilities, sure that she had found something at last. Instantly the blood crept warmly over her body. Her nervous tension relaxed. She walked out into the busy street and discovered a new atmosphere. Behold, the throng was moving with a lightsome step. She noticed that men and women were smiling. Scraps of conversation and notes of laughter floated to her. The air was light. People were already pouring out of the buildings, their labor ended for the day. She noticed that they were pleased, and thoughts of her sister's home and the meal that would be awaiting her quickened her steps. She hurried on, tired perhaps, but no longer weary of foot. What would not Minnie say? Ah, the long winter in Chicago, the lights, the crowd, the amusement. This was a great, pleasing metropolis after all. Her new firm was a goodly institution. Its windows were of huge plate glass. She could probably do well there. Thoughts of Drouet returned, of the things he had told her. She now felt that life was better, that it was livelier, sprightlier. She boarded a car in the best of spirits, feeling her blood still flowing pleasantly. She would live in Chicago, her mind kept saying to itself. She would have a better time than she had ever had before. She would be happy. 4. The spendings of fancy. Facts answer with sneers. For the next 2 days, Carrie indulged in the most high-flown speculations. Her fancy plunged recklessly into privileges and amusements, which would have been much more becoming had she been cradled a child of fortune. With ready will and quick mental selection, she scattered her meager $4.50 per week with a swift and graceful hand. Indeed, as she sat in her rocking chair these several evenings before going to bed and looked out upon the pleasantly lighted street, this money cleared for its prospective possessor the way to every joy and every bauble which the heart of woman may desire. "I will have a fine time," she thought. Her sister Minnie knew nothing of these rather wild cerebrations, though they exhausted the markets of delight. She was too busy scrubbing the kitchen woodwork and calculating the purchasing power of 80 cents for Sunday's dinner. When Carrie had returned home, flushed with her first success and ready, for all her weariness, to discuss the now interesting events which led up to her achievement, the former had merely smiled approvingly and inquired whether she would have to spend any of it for carfare. This consideration had not entered in before, and it did not now for long affect the glow of Carrie's enthusiasm. Disposed as she then was to calculate upon that vague basis which allows the subtraction of one sum from another without any perceptible diminution, she was happy. When Hansen came home at 7 o'clock, he was inclined to be a little crusty, his usual demeanor before supper. This never showed so much in anything he said as in a certain solemnity of countenance and the silent manner in which he slopped about. He had a pair of yellow carpet slippers which he enjoyed wearing, and these he would immediately substitute for his solid pair of shoes. This, and washing his face with the aid of common washing soap until it glowed a shiny red, constituted his only preparation for his evening meal. He would then get his evening paper and read in silence. For a young man, this was rather a morbid turn of character, and so affected Carrie. Indeed, it affected the entire atmosphere of the flat, as such things are inclined to do, and gave to his wife's mind its subdued and tactful turn, anxious to avoid taciturn replies. Under the influence of Carrie's announcement, he brightened up somewhat. "You didn't lose any time, did you?" he remarked, smiling a little. "No," returned Carrie with a touch of pride. He asked her one or two more questions, and then turned to play with the baby, leaving the subject until it was brought up again by Minnie at the table. Carrie, however, was not to be reduced to the common level of observation which prevailed in the flat. "It seems to be such a large company," she said at one place. "Great big plate-glass windows and lots of clerks. The man I saw said they hired ever so many people." "It's not very hard to get work now," put in Hansen, "if you look right." Minnie, under the warming influence of Carrie's good spirits and her husband's somewhat conversational mood, began to tell Carrie of some of the well-known things to see, things the enjoyment of which cost nothing.